In 1969, used furniture dealer Fred Washington bought 12 large discarded notebooks from a garbage collector, where they found a new home in his warehouse under a pile of dusty carpets. In 1969, art history student Mary Jane Victor was scouring through his bazaar of castaways when she came upon the mysterious works of a certain Charles Delshow. Inside the scrapbooks, she discovered a remarkable collection of strange watercolors and collage pieces, more than 2,500 intricate drawings of flying machines, alongside cryptic newspaper clippings filling the pages, crudely sewn together with shoelaces and thread. His story is one shrouded in mystery, almost lost forever, intertwined with secret societies, hidden codes, otherworldly theories, and seemingly impossible inventions before his time. Unseen for decades and salvaged by a junk dealer in the 1960s from a trash heap outside a house in Texas, his entire body of work would later go on to marvel the intellectual world. But during his lifetime, Charles Delshow had only been known as the grouchy local butcher.
Howdy, folks, and welcome back to another episode of your favorite podcast, That Would Be Rad, a podcast that majors in 80s and 90s nostalgia, comic culture, all things paranormal, and minors in retro video games, tabletop RPGs, pre-internet mysteries, and trying to raise our kids to be half as cool as we were back in the 80s. We are your hosts, Woody Brown.
And Tyler Bentz.
How are you, man?
I'm pretty good. I'm feeling all right. I had a migraine yesterday, which was awful, but...
Sorry to hear that.
I'm doing pretty good. How about you, pal? What's going on?
I'm just looking to the skies, man.
Ooh.
You know, I mean,
nice.
We have a solar eclipse. There's fireballs in the sky right after we talk about the Kecksburg UFO that people initially thought was just a fireball in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just crazy stuff is happening. And I'm just trying to survive it all. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. So... this week, we're talking about this super interesting character
that
we promised that we would get into in last week's episode, which was season 4, episode 9, the Kecksburg UFO incident.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some sort of, I would say, strands of connectivity here. I think that you'll agree, Tyler, but also listeners, you'll come to understand that those strands, you know, aren't even really that random. I mean, there's some pretty good connectivity here.
Oh, yeah. And if it feels like we're working backwards, we kind of are in a way. The funny thing is, we actually did bring up Mr. Charles Delshow back season 1 when we were talking about like the Great Airship Mystery. And I believe the Aurora crash was in there, you know. And so we're setting the stage of, you know, this, you know, late 1800s, 1890s up,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, you're not going to find this in history books, basically. But, you know, if you actually look at like the newspapers of the time and you know, don't believe the official narrative that we're taught in schools, you know, that, you know, just two genius brothers from, you know, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina in 1903 flew their silly plane for 12 minutes or 12 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's not true, folks. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you.
Well, that part's true in terms of like it being a personal aircraft. I'll get to that in a second.
But that's not...
I mean...
But the official narrative...
I think what Tyler's point here is, before we get too conspiratorial here...
I'm getting on my soapbox.
Tyler's point is that previous or before this, you know... event that we all know so well from school in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina with the Wright brothers. Before any of that happened, so long before that actually, crazy stuff was flying in the sky and people were seeing it all around the world. Now, you mentioned that we kind of talked about this during all the way back in season 1. And the hilarious thing is if you are new to the show or if you're a longtime listener, you'll know that we make all kinds of empty promises in episodes where we say, you know, one day we're going to do, and then we mention something, and then it takes four seasons to get to it. But here we are today, finally.
Yeah, and it always it's always me saying, we will definitely cover this.
Right.
Which, so, by the way, my mother's maiden name was Kitty Hawk, so.
Are you kidding me?
No, dead serious.
How did I not know that?
Because it's not true, idiot. Move on. Let's go.
Okay. Dang, man. let's see. If you want to know a little bit more about, I think it's very important to kind of build some context and to learn more about all the crazy stuff and the airship mystery and all the things that were in the sky all the way back in the 1880s.
Yeah.
To do so, you can hear more about it on our previous episodes, season one, episode 47, the Aurora UFO crash, and season one, episode 48, the Great Airship Mystery of 1897. Mm-hmm. Now, when you listen to those, you'll find out pretty quickly why Tyler's getting a little, you know, grumpy, a little salty when he's talking about the Wright brothers.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The difference between a simple, you know, solo manned craft and these, giant crafts that were witnessed, filled with dozens sometimes of people or occupants, it's just astonishing. I'm going to give you a little taste real quick just to kind of kick it off. It's something that I know for sure because I went back and re-listened to both of those episodes. We did not talk about this event just so that our listeners today can kind of say, okay, it's just setting the scene for the time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
March 26th, 1880. It was a quiet night in tiny Galistillo, New Mexico. In case you're wondering, that is about 180 miles northwest of Roswell, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So the train from Santa Fe that day had just come and gone, and the operator, now that his daily work was finished, routinely locked up the depot and set out with a couple of friends on a short walk before ending his day. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, voices cut through the silence. Voices which sounded as though they were coming from the sky. At first, the listeners thought their source must be persons in the nearby Ortiz Mountains. But when the voices got louder and closer, the men on the ground looked up and abruptly changed their minds. An object that they described as monstrous in size was rapidly approaching from the west, flying so low that the observers could see elegantly written characters on the outside of the car. Inside, the occupants, numbering 10 or so, and apparently of normal appearance, were laughing, shouting in an unknown language, with sounds of music occasionally drifting out into the air. The craft itself was fish-shaped, like a cigar with a tail, and was driven by a huge, quote, fan. As it passed overhead, a passenger tossed several items from the car. The depot agent and his friends recovered one of them almost immediately, a beautiful flower with a slip of fine silk-like paper containing some characters which reminded the men of ones they had seen on Japanese tea chests. Soon afterward, the aerial machine ascended far into the sky and rapidly sailed away toward the east. The next morning, searchers found a cup, which the witnesses had seen thrown out of the craft, but had been unable to locate in the evening darkness. And they said in the Santa Fe Daily New Mexican newspaper, "It is a very peculiar workmanship, entirely different to anything used in this country." The operator took it and the flower and put them on display. Before the day was over, however, this physical evidence of the passage of an early unidentified flying object had vanished. In the evening, a mysterious gentleman identified only as a, quote, collector of curiosities appeared in town. He examined the finds, suggested that they were of Asiatic origin, and offered a sum of money so considerable that the owner had no choice but to accept. The collector scooped up his purchases and was not seen ever again. So this is the time period and the type of stuff that is going on. And again, I encourage you guys to go back and reference those episodes.
Hear more on That Would Be Rad, Season 1, Episode 47, The Aurora UFO Crash, and Season 1, Episode 48, The Great Airship Mystery of 1897.
So that you can get some more context of the time period and everything. Mm-hmm. Now, I love how Del Chow basically, because of this chance finding of his, I guess, scrapbooks, mm-hmm. notebooks, journals, whatever you want to call them,
yeah.
at a junk shop.
Yeah.
Not only, it was because I think it was full of like newspaper clippings and all this, but also some of his own art.
Yeah.
Oh. Or designs, right?
Well, the whole thing is like, even where there's like just text, like those pages are mm-hmm. still, all of like the borders are covered in like this like style. I mean, it is so beautiful to yeah. me. Like, and apparently back in 2015, there was a big art exhibit over all of his work. So you could go and you could see it. And man, I wish we could go back in time to see it. Well, I mean, if we're going back in time, I guess we would go all the way back to Sonora Aero Club. But yeah, there was like a full thing. You could still find the trailer on YouTube, and it's super fitting because it plays Airplane Over the Sea, mm-hmm. the Neutral Milk Hotel song, and absolutely fascinating guy. But yeah, apparently these books or journals, or they call them notebooks, but I think we should be clear, and you know, we'll provide pictures and stuff, but I mean, they're probably, so the artwork that I do is like 11 by 17. I would say it's at least 17, if not like 20 inches tall, and maybe like 14 or 15 inches wide. I mean, they're all massive, and there's stuff just like falling out of them. They're bound with like shoelaces and baling wire or baling rope. It's fascinating. But apparently this like junk salesman found them. So, well, I mean, there's some back and forth on that, but like apparently they were found like just on a curb to be like thrown out with a bunch of like other trash. And I wonder if maybe someone in the Del Chow like family, maybe they were the last folks that had still remained and they moved out and they were like, well, we just got to get rid of all this trash kind of thing.
So like Tyler was saying earlier, the story of aviation does not begin on December, it can't begin on December 17th, 1903.
Sure doesn't.
You know, way before Orville Wright's, you know, 12-second hop, mm-hmm. We're at Kitty Hawk. Scientists and inventors had struggled to unlock these secrets of powered flight. And like we talked about, well, I'll just quote this. There's an issue of Scientific American back in 1897, and they kind of would refer to this, not really, it wasn't really like a race, a space race or anything like that. It's more of like a, you know.
Sky race.
Sky race, but this is like technological. It was an interesting time back in 1897, right? If you really kind of put yourself back in that time period in comparison to how quickly and sort of exponential technology has improved in our own lifetimes, mm-hmm. you know, back then it was a little bit slower. I mean, they had some big discoveries and stuff, but there was this sort of push to grow and improve life in certain areas in utilizing science and engineering to do so. So in 1897, Scientific American called the, quote, true flying machine, one which is hundreds of times heavier than the air upon which it rests by reason of its dynamic impact and not by the aid of any balloon or gas bag whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So I'm referencing this book by Jerome Clark called The Unidentified.
Awesome.
And he quotes, it's a great book. He quotes this guy named Charles H. Gibbs Smith, who is this British historian, and he's an aeronautical historian, actually. And he specializes, I mean, imagine this being your job. He specializes in the periods before 1910.
Yeah.
So I am supposed to believe, right, that enough crazy stuff happened in 1903,
yeah,
in North Carolina, that somebody can base their entire career and specialty.
Well, pal, let me do you one better.
Hold on, but listen to what this guy says, though, because he's kind of like furthering the narrative here. Mm-hmm. He says, I can say with certainty that the only airborne vehicles carrying passengers which could possibly have been seen anywhere in North America, were free-flying spherical balloons, and it is highly unlikely for these to be mistaken for anything else. No form of dirigible, like a gas bag propelled by an air screw, so this is direct quote, so I don't even know what an air screw is, or heavier than air flying machine was flying or indeed could fly at this time in America.
Well, let me do you one better, which even furthers this, and I think this will cast a very familiar shadow on sort of the history that we've been taught. But so we're told 1903, first sort of electric man-powered flight happened by these two brothers in Kitty Hawk. However, in 1898, there was a circular flying vessel patented by a Friedrich Alexander Joan of Dresden, Germany. That was said to look like a Ferris wheel turned on its side, which is really kind of interesting.
Well, it kind of reminds me of the, what's the biblical one, man?
Oh, yeah, like Ezekiel, Ezekiel's wheels, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wheels within wheels, yeah. But so, but also, where was he from?
Who?
The guy that I just said. That's one of the other interesting points. Nothing is known about this man, but he's from Dresden, Germany.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to Germany in just a second. And it's interesting because there's a lot of these folks, and this kind of opens up some other areas and other threads and strands of connectivity with other cases that we have talked about and or will be talking about in the future, where there's this weird connection with people of import in society. In the scientific community, in the professional community, there's almost like this blend or a blurring, I should say, of defined sort of positions, I guess, right? So like nowadays, it's sort of like you've got this, or when we even think about back then, you've got the oil tycoon, the steel tycoon, the politician, the
robber barons, you know.
Yeah, all these different things. But in reality, like when you start to sort of go back and look at this stuff, there's a lot of blurring of lines here.
Yeah.
A lot of them sort of hung out together.
Well, I think that the way that I kind of view it is it's, you know, for our like Marvel fans or whatever, it's almost like Howard Stark, like Tony Stark's dad, very like, or even Tony Stark, really. It's that like, oh, he's like this genius, but he's also, you know, is a ladies man and drinks a lot. And it's kind of like back in those days, we do glean a lot from these notebooks from Delshall, and you find out that they were always like sort of pranking each other and playing jokes on each other and that kind of thing. Like one of, in the writings, there's one particular sort of passage that talks about how they were doing something with like their, and we'll get into this, but their little airships were called Aeros, A-E-R-O. And, you know, there's something to do with the, you know, some one of the characters was trying to do something and the other one like bet him, well, if you fail to make it do whatever you're trying to do, then you basically have to wheel me around in a wheelbarrow on this particular street in, you know, in Sonora that is just filled with bars, and you have to buy me a drink at every bar. And so, you know, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of like, one of the characters that talks about like came out and his bed was attached to like one of the outer wings. and like, you know, kind of funny stuff like that. So I think through this sort of the years of academia and like, oh, it's very serious. I don't think they really had that back then. So it was very much like you have these like jokers and they're, you know, wealthy and like financiers and they have like regular jobs, but they're also absolute geniuses in their off time. And, you know, they're getting drunk in like the local saloons and all that kind of stuff. Because I mean, this is in the 1800s. So I think that's cool. I like that sort of blurring of
well,
characters.
It reminds me of like if Peter Venkman were there, you know, like he's a scientist, but he's also just like silly and having a good time. So even before this like late 1880s and 1890s, airship stuff that was going on in North America. During the 1850s, mysterious airships regularly crossed the skies of Germany and was one of their sort of most recurrent baffling problems at the time. And it was just before that that a remarkable, enigmatic young German named C.A.A. Delshau immigrated to the United States. Now, here's something that's interesting.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Something out there waiting for us. And it ain't no dead.
Hey, this is Bryce Johnson from the Bigfoot Collectors Club, and you're listening to Tyler and Woody on That Would Be Rad, because that is rad.
As it's talking about him in this book, it's really only Delshau's own sort of testimony that places him in Sonora, California, which at the time was a mining town during the 1850s. And during that time, there's not a whole lot of details of what he was doing. They do know, however, that around the turn of the century, he took up residence in Houston, Texas, married this widow, and lived in basically like seclusion. He was kind of known and dismissed as like an eccentric and really didn't hang out much, spending most of his time kind of like studying and devoting hours. I mean, it kind of starts to sound like us a little bit. devoted hours to this compilation of these scrapbooks filled with clippings, drawings, cryptic notations. And then eventually, and of course, we're going to fill in the blanks a little bit here, died in 1924 at the age of 92. But again, it goes back to this chance discovery many years later that really, I mean, truly, it's the reason why we know it's the reason why we're talking about him today.
Well, one of the things that I think is really interesting, too, is a lot of people say, well, we never quite have a link to him even being in Sonora, right?
Right.
And that was one of the things that I initially had a little bit of a problem with. As far as like, well, like, is all this just like a, you know, like a super glorified art, you know, project or whatever? But a guy that's sort of championed this is a guy named Walter Bosley. He's amazing. I ran across like an old podcast. It's been the Sonora Aero Club has been like something that's like fascinated me for years. And to be honest, like, you know, we did cover, you know, topics that were sort of adjacent to it on season one. And we always meant to come back. But to be honest, I kind of like forgot about it. And I happened to just run across, you know, a random podcast the other day with Walter Bosley. And he kind of mentioned it. And I was like, oh my God, man, I don't know that we ever did that. And that's part of the reason that Woody went back to listen to the old episodes, because it was like, man, I swear, I think that we've covered this. But we didn't. Lucky for you. But anyway, part of the issue was, well, we don't really have him linked to Sonora, but what we do have is his immigration process papers, where we see that in 1856, he lived in Harnes County, Texas, but then we have a missing 4 years up to 1860, where then he would suddenly just show back up in Fort Bend County. So what's interesting, too, is like in the papers, in his notebooks, like he gives like certain dates, and all these dates fall in between those 4 years for the most part, which is pretty cool, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's kind of rewind. I know we're kind of all over the place here, but I want to rewind to these this discovery of the scrapbooks, because eventually they ended up in the hands of a ufologist named P.G. Navarro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, the reason that Navarro knows about this is because when all this was found, so we learned earlier that this art student, this Mary Jane Victor, was kind of the one who, you know, was digging through this furniture dealer, Fred Washington's sort of, I don't know, like storage, like art house kind of thing. And she's basically the one who finds it. Well, when she ran across these pages and realized that, like, oh, wait a minute, this is a little more than just like some, you know, scrapbook, she notified the art director of Rice University, Dominique de Menil, who at the time was Houston's leading fine art patron. She would go on to meet with Washington, snapped up four of the books for $1,500, and then immediately just put them out as an exhibition at the university entitled Flight, Charles Delschau. A Prussian immigrant had finally been discovered nearly 50 years after his death in 1923. And so this happened in 1969, and then that's where UFO enthusiast and researcher Navarro comes in.
Yeah, so he basically, he sees these two large scrapbooks, and they've got all these like old news stories and articles about attempts of various would-be inventors and stuff. But he said that like the thing that really caught his eye were these strange-looking drawings that were in these books that claim, and they were like, he described them in these like cumbersome looking vessels, which he claimed actually had been flown at one time. Mm-hmm. So this just piqued Navarro's curiosity, right? I mean, God, can you imagine, first of all, when we go, you know, we're going to thrift stores, we're going to yard sales, we're trying to look for old school VHS, hoping to find this treasure trove of like 80s horror movies and stuff, maybe some old toys, some old video games. Can you imagine flipping that thing open and seeing these like, I mean, at first, I, you know, prior to this podcast, I would, and seeing these drawings now, it's like, I would just be like, whoa, these are just cool. Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of something from like, oh man, what's the movie that Ann always talks about? Something of Munchausen? Baron von Munchausen?
Baron von Munchausen.
Yeah. It's that kind of art. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of. It, mixed in with like the art that they use for the Feywild D&D adventure that you got me.
Yes. Well, to be honest, it's to give you guys, like you folks that grew up in the 70s and 80s, it's very much like Monty Python.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Which I think they were using it in sort of like ironically, you know, kind of thing. But this is, you know, obviously, he did it like in the 1800s. So, but the one thing that is interesting that Woody was saying is like, so you just imagine all this artwork and all these like flying machines, and then there's like a ton of like written stuff where he's telling stories, he's, you know, leaving like certain dates. Well, this happened, this happened, all kinds of things, and then he'll also have, which is where sort of the scrapbook, quote unquote, title comes in, is. He has like a ton of these like newspaper clippings, which I think is really cool, because I think this is something that the debunkers use to say, oh, see, he was just this weirdo outsider artist, which is what he's sort of he's considered an outsider artist, but almost like a folk artist, which is kind of insane when you look at his work. But the debunkers say, oh, well, look, he has like all these newspaper clippings of like air sites seen over here in Iowa, airship scene over here, airship scene over here. I think what's cool is I better like the idea that he's posting all these things showing like where these airships are flying.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I see this guy as like just sort of like connecting all the dots and being like, oh, good, man. My friend X, Y, and Z flew over there. I'm going to save that for him the next time I see him.
Well, one of the things too is so within the group, and I'm sure Woody's about to get into it, but within the group,
trying to.
No, I'm just trying to provide some heft.
Okay.
Within the group, he was kind of known as like a you know, what's like the like note taker, like stenographer,
like a scribe.
Yeah, kind of. He was basically the guy who was just sort of documenting things. So like a treasurer in a meeting or like something like that. So he never actually flew in any of the ships also, which is another interesting thing. So he was kind of like hired to do this thing. And then it just became like a fascination of his.
So Navarro was just, I mean, his curiosity was just on fire here. He eventually located 10 more of these scrapbooks and even talked to Delshau's stepdaughter, who was at that time now an old woman. He conducted this, as well as detailed as it could be, investigation, poring over the books and, you know, carefully making sense of Delshau's notes, which were penned in English, German, and sometimes even code.
Yeah.
According to Navarro, he said that at least one thing here was obvious. Delshau was of two minds about his project. On one hand, he wanted his, quote, secrets to be known. But on the other, he was afraid to speak too directly for reasons that we're going to get to here in just a second.
Yeah.
So he kind of compromised and wrote in this, I don't know, this fashion aimed at discouraging all but the most determined student, which when I start to think about it, it's kind of like, you know, you could probably, if you're a Star Wars fan, relate it to like, you know, a Jedi, or if you're, you know, Japanese or something, you know, a samurai, or, you know, where there's this sort of master who has this wealth of knowledge that not only should it not be taken lightly, but comes with a lot of responsibility. And also, like, once you do know it, could be potentially dangerous, is just kind of like what I'm thinking, right?
Yeah, but it's a little more, like, political, too, though.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, imagine at this time, and we can kind of dive into our theories in later, but at this time, any time, if there was a technology that existed that was far superior, whomever ends up with it is going to be rising above the rest, sort of, you know? And I think he was kind of nervous about it, but let's keep on diving real quick. So he still kind of left a lot unanswered, according to Navarro. And he says, actually, in a very real sense, he left everything unanswered. It was almost as if he was writing for an audience, if not one in his own day, then one at some period in the future.
Yeah.
Now, when I read that sentence, that was that moment. I can't remember if it made it in the show or not. Yeah. That's what triggered me to say, no matter what we're doing, we're talking about Delshau next week, because you were talking about him, and I just happened to have this book open because I was going to talk about a different case that sort of reminded me of the Kecksburg UFO. And I just happened to flip to this page, and I read that sentence, and I was like, whoa. So it's almost like Delshau understand, he has this understanding that the technology that he is aware of, has seen with his own eyes, is so far advanced than what's going on at the time that he knows that, in a way, what and the way he's writing is really kind of for a future audience.
Right, yeah.
Which is just mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. One of the things that I think that we were really fortunate for is when Navarro kind of, you know, got on the trail of this thing and became fascinated with it. One of the things about Navarro was he was also an artist. And so I think, you know, not saying that like artists have like superpowers or anything, but there's certain things and certain ways that artists would do things that sort of the average person would just kind of gloss right over. But he realized like, oh, wait a minute, like there's a cipher to a lot of these symbols, you know? And I think because he was an artist and he had such an eye for detail and attention to detail that he sort of started, you know, it was already fascinating as it is, like, but he started realizing like, oh, wait a minute, like there's some like secrets in here as well.
What was cool is Delshau would sort of address potential readers like this. He would say, you will blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Oh, you will, Wonder Weaver, you will unriddle these writings. They are my stock of open knowledge. They will end like all others, with good intentions but too weak will to assign and put to work.
Mm.
According to Dale Shaw's notes, in the 1850s, he, and this is where we're going to start getting into it, my man, he and a group of associates, about 60 in all, gathered in Sonora, California, where they formed the Aero Club.
Yes.
And constructed and flew heavier-than-air machines.
Mm-hmm.
They performed their experiments, he says, in an open field near Columbia, a small town not far from Sonora. The club itself, this, what we now have sort of referenced before as the Sonora Aero Club, performed its experiments in secrecy. And its members were not permitted to tell anyone of their work or to use the aircraft for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
One member who threatened to take his machine to the public in hopes of securing a fortune died in an aerial explosion.
Yeah.
The victim, Del Shaw hinted, of murder. Another highly educated mechanic, identified as Gustav Freyer, was called to account by the club for withholding new information from them. Apparently, this was no ordinary social organization. What's cool is, like, I remember you briefly mentioning the Aero Club and everything, and then I had never heard of this this other name, but it says the Aero Club was only a branch, right, of a larger secret society whose initials Del Shaw lists as NYMZA, or as you've heard Tyler refer to it, as NIMZA.
And also, I should add in that the NYMZA is actually sort of translated through
YMCA.
To the YMCA, yeah. No, through Navarro, his cipher. So it never actually says in there, like, NIMZA, but because he created this cipher to sort of break down these, like what he said before, you know, it's like you have it in German and or Prussian English, and then you have this other sort of cryptic, what looks like, you know, some sort of coded language. He has been able to, like, sort of break that down with a cipher. And, you know, the thing that he's talking about is called NIMZA, which it's an abbreviation. They believe there's some back and forth on what a lot of folks believe that is or what it means.
Do you know some of them? Or?
I've heard several, but then I've also heard that there's also an aspect to this, which again, this is odd because it links us to Kecksburg and the Nazi Bell, but it's like partially like hieroglyph, like Egyptian hieroglyphs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Well, according to Navarro, basically Del Shaw wrote almost nothing, very, very little, except to just kind of make some observations that in 1858, somebody named George Newell was the head of NIMZA in Sonora. Otherwise, he only alludes to orders from unnamed superiors who were kind of overseeing the club's activities. He does say, though, that these superiors were not from the government. Del Shaw wrote that once a government official who somehow knew of their work approached club members and tried to persuade them to sell their inventions for use as weapons of war, they were instructed to refuse the offer.
Well, a lot of people believe that basically you had these, and again, at the time, Prussian, but German, you had these Prussian immigrants located in the U.S., right? They're multifaceted, some financiers, some bankers, some, you know, kind of all, they sort of run the whole gamut. The leader of this group is a guy by the name of Peter Manis, who they say was a drunk, but also an absolute genius. Then you have this other group who was sent from Prussia that's referred to as NIMZA. And apparently the story goes, and this is sort of what a lot of folks believe, that Del Shaw was actually sent from NIMZA to kind of show up, be the note taker, be whatever. Mm-hmm. But then while he's there, realized, like, oh, wait, I'm on their side. Like, this is like our thing. Whereas, like, with NIMZA, part of the issue and all of the other, like, the immigrants there that were a part of the Sonora Aero Club, they very much disliked the NIMZA cause because NIMZA basically was wanting to create these flying machines for military purposes.
Mm.
And they were like, absolutely not. Do not do this, da-da-da-da-da. But it talks about in one of the passages, Delshau does, where this, and they just refer to him as that Prussian officer. And so I think that Nimza was sending folks over to kind of like check up and see what's going on and this and that. And they were trying, basically what they were trying to do is they were trying to figure out what Nimza, or figure out what the Sonora Air Club was doing so that they could take it back and militarize that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, it is interesting because Delshau refers to someone from the government. He doesn't say which one, though, right? That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. We'll return after these messages.
It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire. Or a vampire.
You think you really know what's happening around here, don't you?
If anyone out there wants
to. We're fighters for truth, justice, and the American.
Hey, this is Woody.
And this is Tyler. And you're listening to That Would Be Rad.
And now, back to our show. So apparently, they had a number of these aircraft at their disposal. And again, there's about 60-something of these guys in this club. Mm-hmm. Navarro kind of describes some of these crafts. He says that the heavy body of these machines seems to be radically out of proportion to the gas bag or balloon, which is supposed to lift the contraption. Considering the large amount of gas, usually hydrogen or helium, that is required to lift one of today's dirigibles or even a small blimp, it is almost inconceivable that the small quantity of gas used in Delshau's airships would be sufficient to lift it. That is, of course, if it were an ordinary gas, which this wasn't. According to Delshau, it was a substance called NB, which had the capacity to negate weight. I mean, this sounds crazy, but essentially what he's talking about here, man, is anti-gravity.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that's interesting, too, is this NB gas or soup or supa, which is either pronounced like S-U-P-E or S-U-P-P-A. And then there's another place where it's like P-Y-S. I think even that was a code name because if you look at like Navarro seems to think that the PYS supa is like pea soup because in every place that Delshau is drawing it, it's always green, which is interesting because, you know, pea soup. So I think that's just a code word for, you know, kind of thing.
Now, apparently Delshau's writings and recordings of all this stuff is, as Navarro says, kind of curiously pessimistic in tone. In one strange paragraph, it says, "We are all together in our graves. We get together in my house. We eat and drink and are joyful. We do mental work, but everybody is forlorn as they feel that they are fighting a losing battle. But little likelihood is there that fate shall bring forth the right man." Delshau wrote of the human race and even the planet Earth as if he stood apart from them. Another peculiar paragraph that he writes is, it's like, I don't know, it's weird, man. It's kind of archaic. He says, "Your Christian love reaches for the wander place and wanders away from Earth. Planets there are enough where Christian love shall be, as we say so nicely in the book Selag. A drawing elsewhere shows the figure of a devil opening up a crack in the fabric of the sky above one of the arrows." Lastly, it says, "The overall impression conveyed to us is of a man who knew secrets that forever would render him an outsider, isolated from the community of mankind."
Wow. Yeah. I like that. I like the idea that, like, you know, men of greater intellect or greater men, you know, through their sort of Christian love is, you know, trying to ascend Earth and trying to reach like heaven or the heavens, you know. I think that's really sort of poetic, really cool. One thing about Delshau that is kind of interesting is, and again, this sort of, one thing about me that you'll learn through four seasons is like the folks that are just your hardcore like debunkers. It's like their whole job is just to like, you know, say, oh, well, this thing isn't real. This thing isn't real. One of the things that they use is they say, oh, well, there's no way all of these stories could have been remembered so vividly because, you know, like I said before, Delshall lands or through his immigration papers, you see that he's in Harris County, Texas, 1856 to 1860. And then he's there in 1856. Then he kind of disappears off the map. And then he shows up again in 1860 in Fort Bend County. So if we're to believe that, then that means that those 4 years were the missing years where he was doing all this work. And then later down in life, he would go on to pretty much retire in 1899. And, you know, from then on, it said that he was, you know, basically knocking out these, you know, like I said before, 2,500 meticulously detailed pages of all this stuff. So a lot of people think like, oh, well, it's just a story and it's just the rantings of a retired, you know, old man or whatever. But I think I don't see anything wrong with that. I think there's plenty of, you know, folks out there who, you know, did some great thing earlier in their youth. They worked till they retire. Then it's, I mean, literally what we were texting the other day about you doing that, this elephant painting.
Oh yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for my dad. Thank you.
And you were like, I picture myself being an old man and like sitting in the backyard, like just painting.
Nature painting.
Yeah. Man. And so I feel like this is no different. This is this guy who had this fantastic thing, but it's for 4 years of his life. And it was the thing that he would never stop thinking about, would never, you know, after the death of the leader, Peter Menes. So once he retired, he's like, oh, wow, I have the time and I have the resources. I'm just going to sit and try to remember as much as I can and put it all down and all that. And it kind of kept him going. And I think that's cool.
It's very cool, man. I think it's important to kind of add to just the overall mystery of it all. Is that like, and again, this is an encouragement to go back and listen to The Great Airship Mystery because we talk about specific cases in there. And in the book that I'm holding right now, there's like 20 pages of nothing but like sighting, event.
Yeah.
Now, something that is sort of in common with all of them that's extremely interesting is that most of these events between 1896 and 1897, this flap of these airships that were seen all across the United States, not to mention the ones that previously were seen all around the world, they don't really seem to possess the sort of paranormal overtones that we kind of see later,
right?
In the 1900s and stuff, and or sort of related with the UFO phenomenon in general. In fact, the airship pilots themselves and the people, the occupants, most of them anyway, were essentially either human or very, very human-like. There's no like, well, I say no. There's mostly no sort of like alien grays or like the hairy Italian guy.
I mean, in some you'll see like what they call smoked or smoky glasses, basically like goggles, or you'll see some with like helmets. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't really see, I mean, especially not any sort of grays, which that's kind of much later, really.
Right. And for the most part, like anytime they interact with the occupants, like there was this one story that we talk about in The Great Airship Mystery that I had completely forgotten about. And it's like this farmer just happens upon this ship and the guy's like, he's like, hey man, what are you doing? He's like, hey, I need, and I forget what he calls it. I don't know. It'd be awesome if he called it pea soup. It isn't that, but he needs some sort of fuel.
Is this
some kind of rock, a blue rock or something?
Oh, I remember us talking about that. That was fascinating.
Like, but the guy just, it's like, I'm a human, you're a human. Hey man, I need X, Y, and Z, you know?
Yeah, it was like tourmaline or something.
Yeah, and the guy's like, well, I don't think we've got any of that at the general store.
Although, dude, I did not even think about that, but that is really interesting because, you know, so the soup that we were talking about, which is like the what would be considered quote unquote lifting fuel or lifting gas back in the day. Walter Bosley, who again is just fantastic, he's awesome, but he's really kind of taken up the charge. In fact, him and a few other guys have created this new conference called NIMSACON, which is
what?
In, yeah, dude, I just found this out today, which is in Sonora, and we've got to go because it sounds amazing. But the interesting thing is he sort of believes at some point that, well, so basically Charles Delshaw talks about how there's some sort of like spinning apparatus, and you mix this sort of like powder with water in the spinning thing, right? And the spinning thing basically creates the gas, which fills up the container, and that allows for, you know, some sort of like propulsion or whatever. And you know, then to lower it, you open like a vent, and it allows that gas out, and therefore it like pulls you back down. And so he believes that there could be a possibility that it's somehow tied to some sort of like stone, like a, not necessarily like emerald, but like there's different folks mm-hmm. also.
It was bluestone. That's what it was, dude. They called it bluestone.
Yeah. So maybe this like green stuff that makes the soup and this bluestone, maybe they're sort of similar things. Like maybe mm-hmm. they're turning these stones to powder, and then somehow mm-hmm. that, you know, when mixed with ammonia,
something
or
yellow, blue and yellow make green.
Man. I mean, there you go.
You
bro.
Know what I mean?
Yeah, that could be true. But yeah, that's pretty fascinating. And another thing real quick, sorry, but jumping way ahead, when we, you know, we briefly talked about the Nazi bell, the mm-hmm. the Die Glock. Last week, we talked about how, you know, sort of surrounding this urban legend, if you will, there's also talk about there being like a mercury accelerator in there. So it basically mm-hmm. using like mercury, which is something that in the fringe sort of areas of sort of technology and in technological advancements, there's a lot of like, oh, well, this like red mercury or these like mercury propelled things. So like that could be something too that's sort of tied into it. I don't know, but it's pretty fascinating though.
And another thing that kind of binds it all together too was that initial story that I talked about where in New Mexico, where the craft was flying so sort of slowly that mm-hmm. the guys, the witnesses, could see like these hieroglyphics on the side.
Yeah.
And then the cup that they found the next day had what they could only describe as like Japanese, which is kind of what we talked about last week. You know, that's their frame of reference, either, you know, Egyptian writing or Japanese.
Yeah.
In fact, they didn't even mention Egyptian writing in the story. They only related it to Japanese because probably at that time, somebody in random town, New Mexico, isn't really familiar with a bunch of the King Tut stuff.
No. That's interesting too, because, you know, if we're looking at this era, I mean, I don't even think it was till like the 40s when we truly had access to a lot of the mm-hmm. sort of what we know now as like her sort of Egyptian iconography and, you know, knowing about all that stuff. I know there was like a massive, like it was a big fad to be like into all the Egyptology stuff with like the Art Deco mm-hmm. movement and stuff. But one of the things that I do, sort of jumping off of what you just said, so Peter Navarro and then this other guy named William Steen and Walter Bosley, they've all kind of drawn these like similarities between in some of Delshaw's journals, you see some areas where what looks like, I think originally this William Steen character, he came before Navarro. He was like really big into trying to figure out Delshaw's work. But he thought that whatever this sort of coded language was he thought that's what was on some of the photos of the arrows, the flying machines. But mm-hmm. Navarro noticed that like, oh, no, this is like, which is really cool to see this sort of ongoing research happening. And, you know, as the generations go by, and then this guy's from this further later generation, you know, and then Walter Bosley, like much later, you know, it's like now we're able to look on the internet. Now we can see all this stuff. And he's noticed that like what once was thought as like, oh, well, this is just Delshaw's weird sort of coded language. No, this is actually on some of these photos are Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Man.
And so what's interesting is you see the hieroglyphs here. You see the hieroglyphs supposedly on, which, I mean, we can get into that in a minute. I originally didn't think this, but But of course, now you see the hieroglyphs possibly on the bell, the Nazi bell. And mm-hmm. then you also see them on last week's episode, the Kecksburg acorn.
Mm.
So,
man,
I basically, you want to get into like what we think?
Well, real quick, I think we need to make an agreement together as an audience, and then you and I as the folks delivering this story to them.
Never.
I think we can all agree that the 19th century, the world of the 19th century, I guess, had neither the knowledge or really the means to successfully fly these heavier-than-air machines other than perhaps what we're hearing. In other words, we know that, like, the technology isn't public information. We know that it's not widespread. It's not general knowledge. It's just, you know, like, happening everywhere. Everyone's got their own airline. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But with some crazy frequency of the numerous events that occurred around the world, we can be certain that these things were happening, that crafts of that sort were being seen and described by people, right? And, well, let's just say this, okay? When I first initially, with some of those earlier cases, occupants were described sometimes as like being, like wearing all white, mm-hmm. or the music being, you know, either they did not speak the same language or it took them a second and then they brought somebody out that did speak that language and they were sometimes, you know, singing and they could hear music and stuff. Throughout history, so many different groups and societies, whether they're secret or not, have sort of accepted this idea that in one way or another, we've been in contact with higher beings who basically taught us things and or oversaw our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, religions, cults, even black magic, spiritualists, flying saucer contactees, everybody kind of can kind of come together with that common thread that, like, at some point, there's some sort of, like, connection and or interaction with a higher being of some sort that sort of, like, delivers knowledge. I mean, even some scientists can even sometimes will say that they've been, and you and I, Tyler, have talked about this in terms of how we feel and our opinions on, like, being able to write music and that kind of thing. Sometimes you just feel like it's inspired by something that is from somewhere else. It's the only way that you can explain it, really, just being able to, like, sit there
yeah.
and all of a sudden the lyrics and music and melody all comes out at once.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And so let's suppose for just a second, this is where, like, I don't know why, I just love this idea. So what if, all right, here's not necessarily my theory, but just a theory that I think is really cool. Okay, imagine that there's this secret society of these brilliant scientists, engineers, you know, inventors and all this. They believe at some point that they've established this contact with, I don't know, a paranormal force that basically told them how to construct these aerial vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And then ordered them to keep the work under wraps. Presumably the American and German branches were kind of working, or they knew of each other, maybe even in communication with one another. And around 1848, some of those Germans migrated in order to pool their efforts with those of the American cohorts, kind of, again, setting up shop near Sonora, California. And eventually, for whatever reason, I think maybe, like you said, that NIMSA version of the organization versus the Sonora Aero Club, mm-hmm. there's kind of this dissent or this dissension between them and this sort of hope that someone that, again, Del Shau called like the right man would arrive to maybe defy superiors and make the airship public or whatever, you know, whatever that dissension was. Maybe they didn't agree with that. Maybe they did. Maybe some people wanted to, you know, turn a profit on it. Some people didn't. Anyhow, the Germans who stayed in their home country, maybe they're the explanation for the 1850s flap that happened in Germany. And maybe, like, and, you know, along that sort of line of thinking, take the paranormal piece out of it, time travelers out of it, anything like that. Let's just say it's just this group of wealthy and also group of scientists and engineers, inventors that have come together and they're just making stuff for fun.
Mm-hmm.
They stumble across this technology, this anti-gravity pea soup or bluestone, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and they're able to, they created something just like whoa, magnificent. They all agree, hey, man, we can't tell anybody about this because you know what's going to happen. Because a lot of times I think brilliant artists, engineers, scientists, inventors, they carry a heavy weight on their shoulders as well with the fear that whatever they create could at one point cause the destruction of millions, if not billions of people, right? In some way, ruin humanity. So maybe...
Hashtag CERN.
Yeah. Maybe they have this awareness, right? So that they're kind of afraid. They're like, hey, look, we got to keep this under wraps because, you know, the second that anybody hears about this in the government, they're going to want to come in and take control. And you know what I mean?
Which is exactly what I think happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things also that I think is interesting is the idea, and I think Delshall sort of, I think he's slightly kind of alludes to this. He doesn't really go into it too far, but it's the idea that possibly the design of these arrows are or were like inspired by the Vimanas, which are these like flying machines from the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. Or the Bhagavad Gita, like ancient, you know, Indian text, like we're talking like first millennium BCE era, you know, super, right. Super old. But it is interesting because in those Hindu epics, you see that they're flying machines. You mm-hmm. see that they basically have what are like, you know, flaming spears or flaming arrows that it like explodes. So they're basically like talking about missiles. Mm-hmm. That's the only one of the only places on planet Earth also where you can find areas to where, you know, and this is again, this is like during like excavations where they find like, you know, when they're digging up ancient ruins and stuff, they're finding where the sand has been like turned to like a glass crystalline kind of thing, which only happens
high heat. Right?
No, not even just high heat. Only happens within like an atomic type explosion, which is really fascinating because people for years have said, "Oh, well, you know, maybe these Vimanas are basically just like spaceships and they're just flying around, you know, blasting each other out of the sky." Well, it is interesting that Delshall slightly sort of alludes to that in his work. I think that's mm-hmm. really cool.
We will return after these messages.
Hey, this is Woody.
And this is Tyler. And you're listening to That Would Be Rad.
And now, back to our show. I mean, man, the more I really think about it, I feel like this is, in a way, sort of insulting the brilliant minds that existed hundreds and, if not thousands of years ago. But dude, it's real hard for me not to think there's some sort of, hey, this is how you, I mean, gosh, the Greeks mm-hmm. had Icarus, you know?
Right.
I mean, we were all sort of like taught even the most basic form of sort of, quote, technology. In other words, how to make fire. Like in our mythology, it's just very hard for me not to think like at some point somebody is teaching mm-hmm. or showing, you know, even maybe I think about I don't even know if it's an urban legend, but the device that supposedly exists where you can kind of almost like a TV and you can like.
You're talking about the Antikythera mechanism?
Yes.
Yeah.
That you can look at different moments in history and.
Oh, no. That's the Chronovisor.
The Chronovisor, right? Yeah. And so like, is it possible that at some point people in the far, far distant past, I'm talking those ancient Hindus, or mm-hmm. it always goes back to people have these interactions with either beings or who they might even consider like a demon, daemon, djinn, fey. I mean, it's all these different names. It just reminds me of that Passport to Magonia cover where you've got this.
Oh, I love it.
You know,
the masks.
Alien sort of holding up all these different masks.
Yeah.
And it's all, it's like all the same thing, man.
Yeah. But then, well, but then isn't it, once you like open the cover, isn't it like something else? It may not be on the newer copies. I think on the original, you could like, you would open the cover like flap and it actually revealed that it did look almost like a demon.
It's up on the shelf and I don't want to get it right now.
Okay. No. I definitely see what you mean. I mean, you know, if we're talking about that, you even look at things like John Dee and Edward Kelly, how they, you know, had this like black, like seeing stone, and that's how they were communicating with angels. And
well, I mean, same with Joseph Smith in the Mormon religion.
Yeah.
He basically had a couple stones that he was able to use to translate these plates. And guess what, man? They had an ancient language written on them.
Yeah. Yeah.
In America.
Yeah. Whew, well, man. We'll get into that in a minute. But
I was going to say it at another time.
Well, no, I'm just going to, I mean, I'm going to get into like how sort of my current belief system, and again, this is current, so by season 6, it'll be totally changed. But before I do that, here's what I think has happened over the, you know, when I walk through the gates of heaven and I'm allowed to ask questions and get definitive answers on what happened, this is what I think they're going to tell me. I think
they're going to say, never heard of it.
Never heard of it. No, I believe that you had this group of immigrants come over here and they truly were sort of, you know, waving the banner of like exploration and creativity. And you know, I mean, you got to think of it too, like that had to be sort of exhilarating coming from Prussia to this new land of opportunity where there's gold and there's like this and America's massive and there's so many different like sort of ecosystems and surroundings and stuff. It was just, it had to be an exhilarating time. And so I think you have these guys who had, you know, no real motives per se, but then you had the group where they came from that was like, no. If they're going over here figuring out flight and these new explorations, we're sending some folks over to make sure we figure it out. I think basically that, you know, who they refer to as that Prussian officer that was sent over that apparently nobody liked within the Sonora Aero Club, I believe that that guy probably got all the information you need, whether he took some of the diagrams, yada, 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 whatever, maybe took some of Del Shaw's stuff. I believe that he then went back to what was then Prussia. Eventually, it would turn into Germany. And then, you know, as we know, World War II. I mean, there's a big gap there. And I think possibly the reason there was such a big gap before we see the Nazi bell is because apparently the urban legend is the leader of Sonora Aero Club, Peter Menes, he died with the secret for making the soup. Mm. And so this Prussian agent goes back, takes it over, and it's like, hey, we got everything, but we don't know how the hell to lift this thing off the ground and make it work, right?
And you've got like Del Shaw. It doesn't seem like he's hiding necessarily, but
it's
certainly probably
is,
saying like, oh, no, I don't, you know, I'm not a part of that anymore. And he's just got these scrapbooks because he, like you said earlier, he's got these fond memories, or he's just trying to like maybe even keep track of it in a sense to maybe even potentially, here's what I'm thinking. I feel like he, in this way, I get this vibe that he didn't want this to fall into the wrong hands.
Right,
and
for
so
sure.
He's tracking these things, seeing their progress and thinking like, okay, no, they're, I don't have anything to worry about yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I also think too that he, a lot of the reason for the that sort of weird coded language that he uses occasionally in the notebooks, I do think that that was probably because of things like, you know, the Prussian officer that nobody liked. So it's like, hey, here's all of our stuff. And then like, there's a couple things that would typically help you sort of tie everything together. And he's like, well, I'm going to go ahead and write that in a coded language.
Yeah.
Just
in case. Almost exactly like it would be like when we were in our band, The Modern Society, we would show up somewhere and everybody's like, man, everybody is so cool except that Tyler guy.
Yeah, they used to call me that Prussian officer in the band.
Exactly.
But basically, I think it took them that long to get somewhat close to making this thing work. As far as like the Nazi bell, you know, so we're talking, I mean, Peter Menes died in like the early 1860s. And so we don't really see anything until the Nazi bell stuff in, you know, World War II. I don't have the like specific dates, but
yeah,
I think it took him that long to kind of figure out. Then what I think happened is I mean, it really is like a funny game of like telephone. If this is what happened, maybe nothing happened like this.
And it's, right.
I'm totally wrong, but this is just in my mind how it kind of makes sense. So then basically, I don't necessarily believe that the Germans lost the war. I think they just relocated to Argentina and or Antarctica, but that's another show.
Well, and we've talked about that, and you can find that on episode.
Hear more about this on That Would Be Rad, Season 3, Episode 14, April Oddities. The Bizarre History of Hitler's Fake Death, UFOs, and the Edison Food Machine.
So I think either us taking over that stuff, or what's probably even more plausible is when we took all of those Nazi scientists through Operation Paperclip, Project Paperclip, which then would go on to create NASA, by and large, by having Nazis create it for us. I believe that those guys did kind of have that technology, or at least some of the technology, like possibly they worked on it or they had knowledge of it in the later era. Because that is like a big gap between, you know, 1860 and then World War II. I mean, that's like a big gap. So, you know, maybe somebody's father worked on it, whatever. And then I think having those German / Nazi scientists over here, I think we created our own bell, and maybe it wasn't as successful. Maybe it was, but regardless, I do think a specific iteration of that is the Kecksburg UFO crash. And I think, and again, this isn't like the fun, like cool, that would be rad answer that we would, that I particularly would usually have where it's like, oh, no, it's 100% like ET, you know. I believe that the reason that our military knew to show up so fast when it crashed, I think because they were tracking it the whole time. I think that it was like some sort of like test run, and it was just like a, you know, just a test to see how it would go, maybe long distance travel kind of thing.
Right.
But I think that it was ours. Here's the thing that I do think that is really taking it back to the esoteric sort of weird side of That Would Be Rad. I do think there's something really interesting in those Egyptian hieroglyphs in the Del Shal book on his drawings, you know, on his the arrow vehicles, the arrows, to the Nazi bell and then all the way to the Kecksburg thing. So I wonder, did that have something to do with it? Did that have, or was that, or did they just think, oh, well, maybe, you know, this is just what we saw on these Del Shal drawings, and he had these weird symbols, so let's go ahead and put them on the bell. And then when we made it, it's like, oh yeah, well, it was on the bell, so let's go ahead and put them on the Kecksburg acorn. Like, it is a funny game of telephone.
Let me surprise you with a more That Would Be Rad explanation.
Okay, cool.
Like, it's hilarious that the tables have turned here. What if those were some sort of, like, warding glyphs that were meant to like ward off evil spirits or whatever.
Yeah.
That maybe whenever you're utilizing this craft would, you know, I don't know. Something weird like that.
Well, it's interesting you said that because I also
didn't explain it as cool as I wanted.
No. I also had this thought, and the reason why I did was it took me back to Edward Leed Scanlon. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because he was the 4'8" tall gentleman that built the Coral Castle all by himself. Nobody could figure it out. They said they would hear moaning or like a humming sound at night. And that's all that we know of how one man built this entire you know, limestone castle in Florida. And not only that, but then he moved it all, like, down the road.
Now, where was he from originally? Is that where you're getting to?
No, I do think he was, I think, was he, like, Polish, maybe?
Okay, maybe.
I don't think he was necessarily, I don't know, maybe he was.
German.
Could be, yeah. But the one reason that I thought about that is it was said they asked him how he did it, and it was in, like, a, you know, an old, like, local newspaper interview or something, and he said, if you know the secrets to the pyramids, you'll know how I created the Coral Castle. And I think, you know, I mean, we talk about Nikola Tesla, you know, he talked about, like, everything revolves around resonance, sound, mm-hmm. and vibration. And so I wonder if it's that same thing. And one of the things, too, about Edward Lean Skouden is, like, after he died, they found these, like, little books that he had written, like, I mean, basically kind of like pamphlets that were also, they believed, were coded that were called, like, Secrets of the Pyramids or weird, like, you know, Egyptian mystery schools. Like,
and I know we're dropping a lot of references to previous episodes, but you can listen more about the Coral Castle here.
Hear more about this on That Would Be Rad, Season 2, Episode 23. The Coral Castle.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely something to it. I've always believed that the pyramids they're sort of related to, like, sound and that kind of thing, like harmonics and that whole kind of deal with, like, being able to levitate thing, anti-gravity. But I don't know. It is funny if that's what kind of went down. Like,
well, I mean, if God almighty, dude, if they had technology like that back then, I mean, boy, that puts another spin on the old Jericho thing, right?
100%. That's exactly,
because, I mean,
it's in the same vein. Yeah.
They're writing based, we talk about this a lot on this show. You write or you describe something based on your own life experience. Mm-hmm. And if you are in old school Middle East and this wall gets knocked down by this sound,
trumpets,
this wall of sound of what they described as trumpets,
some sort of horn,
they can only describe that because, well, I mean, I've heard a horn before, so I guess that was it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, which
that sounds a little disrespectful the way I'm kind of
that's exactly right,
but you know what I'm saying, like, it's not too, like, it's one of those things where if this then boom 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 boom, boom.
Yeah, right.
That's what happens when we start talking about all these things. And again, we're not here trying to pretend like we know what the answer is, because how boring would that be, really? It's the, just like in true science, the exploration of all the possibilities and trying to figure out if this fits or if that fits to discover it, man. That's the raddest part about it all, really.
Yeah, for sure.
And ultimately, as far as Dilshow is concerned, like, I kind of feel sad for him because he seems like a guy that was sort of torn between having this knowledge and sort of feeling like an outcast, especially once I feel like there may have been some sort of disagreement that he had with the Sonora folks too, because he sort of just isolated himself, moved off in a way.
Well,
and so I
kind of think that it was probably, I think that it there was probably more to do with NIMSA and those kind of folks, because I think once Peter Menes died, the leader, I think they were sort of like, well, you know, what do we do now? We don't really have a leader to kind of tell us where to go, what to do. And then I think you probably had a lot of other sort of influence coming from, you know, the Germans at the time. And so I think they probably were like, hey, we got to get out of Dodge and, like, move over here, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, I don't know. It is interesting, though.
Yeah.
One thing, by the way, that I think this happened in the Civil War, was like 1860s. Apparently, like, right around the Civil War, which, again, would have been right around the time that, like, Peter Menes died. Apparently a guy, and I should have got more research into this, but apparently there was a guy who showed up to Abe Lincoln, and somehow he contacted his, like, you know, war advisory, you know, captain or whatever. And he basically proposed, like, hey, I have access to this flying machine, and I think it could really benefit, you know, the war effort kind of thing. And the story goes, he was basically just turned down. And they're like, oh, no, 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 we're not interested in that. But I wonder if what actually happened was the leader of this club passes away. The club kind of disbands. There's a guy who's like,
I have
a sketchbook of all the stuff that I and us have been working on. I'm going to go make money off of it and take it to the U.S. military. And did that. And then the public, you know, the public response that we're given is like, oh, no, 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 we don't have time for that. But we do know that it leads up to him actually having a personal meeting with Abraham Lincoln, which I would imagine was not the easiest thing to do. So,
right.
So for that to even happen, that feels a little interesting. But then I think maybe that's the point where if it didn't go back to the Nazi Bell thing, or maybe they were, you know, maybe the Germans and maybe us, private sector, sort of black budget stuff, maybe we were both working on this technology at the same time, like concurrently. You know what I mean? And maybe that's where the Kecksburg, so maybe the Nazi Bell never even made it over here, but the Kecksburg was sort of
our version. Now, just to clear up anything, many of the craft that we've talked about in the airship stuff didn't look anything like either the Nazi Bell or the Kecksburg UFO.
I mean, there's a couple in Del Shall's book, though. There are a couple that are,
I mean, kind of, yeah,
that are a little strange. The thing that is difficult, and I love it for this, I love, like, artistically, I think it's so beautiful, but it is kind of hard to differentiate the sort of technology with his sort of stylistic art approach.
Interpretation of it, yeah.
Yeah, that's where it gets a little tough. It's like, you know, and me being an artist, I look at it and I'm like, man, I don't know. Like, is this just, is this him taking, like, artistic liberties to, like...
Or it might be that his skills were about my level, where I would try to draw something and it would be, like, just off enough where it couldn't be realistic in terms of proportions and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, man. I feel like, too, I do like the idea of these guys just kind of, like, sitting around and, like, whoa, oh, God, Kevin's flying it tonight, you know?
Yeah.
Having a couple of cocktails and just, like, you know, flying these things around experimentally. It's just, I don't know. It's a crazy time. What's interesting, too, a final detail that I'm going to sort of put in here that this book talks about is the fact that, like, we think now, because of all the other things that have appeared in the sky ever since then, that people would be just, like, terrified about it. But in fact, at the time, it was really the opposite effect. Most people sort of just saw it as, like, oh, wow, you know, like, because they reported it in newspapers and stuff, too.
Oh, constantly.
And they would just sort of, the just common folk would just sort of be like, man, I mean, this is a very neat sort of technological advance, and see, like, we're becoming, and so there's all these other things happening industry-wise in the United States at the same time, and in, frankly, in the world, you know, more industrialized, more, it happened at this moment in history that, for whatever reason, at that time, they didn't think of it like, oh, man, there's these scary creatures. There was nothing, like, nightmarish about it, you know? Which is super interesting and so different.
Other than the Aurora crash.
Well, that one, and also, like, the time when this guy's, like, I think ladder or something hooked his cow and just, like, poor cat, man. But, like, you know, for the most part, though.
Wait, didn't it, like, take his cow? I know there's one where it took his cow.
Yeah, yeah. It, like, hooked onto the cow.
Onto the cow,
flying with it, and then it, like, dropped a mile and a half away.
Yeah, that's that one,
you know,
yeah.
Fell on the ground, the poor thing.
If you've enjoyed this show, come on over to Instagram. Tell us about it. Tell us about all the things that we missed about this fascinating and brilliant story of Charles Del Shall and the Sonora Aero Club. Leave us a comment. Shoot us a DM. All those things. If you'd like to tell us your own story or maybe your own urban legend or, you know, whatever, head over to Gmail to send it to thatwouldberadpod@gmail.com. Even better than that, and what we would really love to hear is your story or your urban legend or whatever in your own voice. And you can do that at thatwouldberadpodcast.com. over at our website. Leave us a 5-star review. It really does help us a lot. We really can't stress it enough. You know, as much as these two old men hate having to, like, you know, fight the algorithm and all that nonsense, like, it's just a thing that has to be done these days. And so we really do appreciate it when you guys take the time to do that. Get out there, tell one single friend about the show. Also, if you do run across a Del Shout notebook, please reach out to us. We would love to see it.
Yeah. Also, lesson learned here, if you could take away one thing from this episode, it's that when you go to these estate sales, when you go to a thrift store, when you go to a yard sale, because tis the season right now, it's nice and pretty and warm outside, just be on the lookout for weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what you're going to find.
You never know. That's true. Well, head on over to Patreon, The Rabbit Trail. It's where you can support us in real time. And we're so grateful and so appreciative of you folks parting with your hard-earned money to help support these two fledgling podcasters in our fight to, you know, fight the good fight and get out all these topics. Anyway, I'm rambling already. We love you. Mm-hmm. We appreciate you. And as always,
be rad.
That's the way it goes. Always said our future would be a parade.